Hello, and welcome back to The Fragile Juggernaut, our limited-run podcast on the history of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, or the CIO. I'm Tim Barker, and I'm here today with Ben Mabee.
Hey, Tim.
Emma Teitelman.
Hi.
And Andrew Elrod.
Hello.
We left off last time in 1929, the last year in an unbalanced decade, which saw dramatic economic changes, which benefited workers unevenly, if they benefited workers at all. Today, we're going to cover the years from 1929 and the beginning of the Great Depression, through 1933.
1933, you may remember, was the first year of FDR's New Deal. But one thing we really want to emphasize in this episode is that the labor organizing, which would later grow into the CIO, was already underway before the New Deal. It preceded FDR. And there were more than 3 years of utterly brutal economic crises before FDR took over. And the difficulties this caused for millions of workers were so fundamental that they simply couldn't wait for a new president to solve the problems for them. These years saw a truly historic wave of kind of popular self-organization. The complex interaction of these mass movements with high politics would go on to shape much of modern U.S. history.
And one of the key concepts that we're going to be talking about is social reproduction and the idea of the Depression as a crisis of social reproduction. So what is social reproduction? It is all of the activities, whether they're waged or unwaged, that are required to create and maintain and reproduce the commodity labor power. So if you think about a worker showing up to work every day, what does the worker sell? The worker sells her labor power. But what are all of the things that are required to produce that worker and her labor power in the first place? We can think about eating. We can think about shelter. We can think about care. On a kind of macro level, we can think about education as a process that reproduces the next generation of workers and their labor power. And so to think about the Depression as a crisis of social reproduction is to say that all of these processes that were required to reproduce workers and their labor power were suddenly brought to a halt. So it's not just that a few firms failed here and there, or a single sector was struggling, or just that profit rates were slowing. The Great Depression and the mass unemployment and devastation that it produced deprived working people of the things that they relied on to survive, wages, which is how they would purchase the things that they needed to reproduce themselves. And so the Depression threatened the continued reproduction of the working class and of their labor power. And so in other words, it undermined the conditions of possibility for capitalism.
Yeah, this episode's about thinking about this crisis of social reproduction that becomes more and more severe as the Depression rolls on, particularly in the third and fourth years of the Depression, and how that kind of depression and the crisis of social reproduction that it inaugurated kind of gave way to new forms of working class fight back, new strategies of survival, and even tepid forms towards relief and government intervention and destabilizing both the economic situation, but also the basic structure of society. So this period that we're going to cover in this episode after the Great Crash is really crucial, in part because the seeds of what become industrial unionism really start to take root here.
I expect that most of you already know Miss Florence Reese.
I'm not a coal miner, as you well know, but I'm as close as I could be not to be one. My father was a coal miner who was killed in the mines, and my husband is slowly dying with black lung. And my husband and me was in the strike in the 30s in bloody Harlan County, and I do mean it is bloody, too. And they tell me, these miners say, we're going to stick it out unless Duke Power signs the contract till hell freezes over. Got nothing to lose but their chains and their union to gain. So I say, hang in there. And now this song I composed in the 30s. And as you know, I'm old, that's 40 years ago, and I can't sing very well. But you can ask the scabs and the gun thugs which side they're on, because they're workers too. Come all you poor workers, good news to you I'll tell. How the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? If you go to Harlan County, there is no neutral there. You'll either be a union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on? Which side?
What actually was the Depression?
Well, it might be useful to step back before we get to the ground level social history and look at the Depression as a macro phenomenon, not just economically, but sociologically in terms of the, you know, the effect of the economy on demographics. Understanding what was going on in the economy was difficult for people at the time to do. We tend to learn about the Depression through unemployment statistics and GDP, but at the time that it was happening, neither of these things existed as anything published by the government or even agreed upon conceptually by social scientists, and there were no standard surveys to measure them. One thing we do know is that there was a financial panic in October of 1929, which saw a tremendous collapse in financial values, securities, stocks and bonds, and real estate values. That was followed by a severe deflation, falling prices in both manufacturing and agricultural goods. The price structure of American industry throughout the 1920s had remained elevated in manufacturing since the war, but in agriculture, prices began falling just after the war, which was a problem because farmers had taken out a lot of debt during the war boom to finance investments. Just as an example of some price trends, using 1919 as an index of 100, prices for farm-produced commodities fall down to around 70 by 1925 and then below 30 by 1931. This meant during the 20s that there was already a steadily growing migration from farms to cities, around 500,000 people in net migration into the cities for much of the 20s per year. And this really accelerates with the Depression. At the same time, non-farm prices are falling by much less, you know, from 100 in 1919 to around 50 in 1931. So the things that people who aren't in the cities have to buy from the cities aren't getting as cheap as the farm commodities that they have to sell to earn the money to buy those things. So the shock of the Depression was not unlike the pandemic, not in the sense of the of unemployment, but in the sense that, you know, there are these new economic trends that pre-exist a shock that then reorganizes the society around these new forces. But unlike with the coronavirus pandemic, the new forces in the 1920s of increasingly productive agriculture that was shifting people off the farms was not met after the financial panic with an increasing purchasing power to re-employ the farm population in the cities. And this is what made the Great Depression, part of what made the Great Depression so terrible. There weren't official unemployment statistics until 1934, when the Congress established something called the Committee on Economic Security. But when it did release its report, it gave us some figures to understand the magnitude of the crisis. 4 million people were thrown into unemployment each year of the Depression, they found. So by 1930, it's about 4 million unemployed. By 1931, it's about 8 million unemployed. And by 1932, there's about 12 million unemployed people. And this is out of a labor force of about 48, 49 million or so. So 9% unemployment in the first year, up to about 30% in the fourth year, which is just a tremendous disruption to social life.
It's been described as if many communities and industries suffered an almost total devastation. You know, Irving Bernstein writes that it was almost as if they'd been visited by natural disaster. In some cities, there was only, you know, cities that boasted almost 1,500 workers, they could only name two residents with a job. In one town of Benton, 2,000 children hadn't tasted milk for a year. Even Sidney Hillman's clothing workers, such an important dynamo organization that we kind of discussed in the teens and 20s, his New York membership dwindled to 10%. Only 10% of their members even had a job. When Birmingham, Alabama advertised 750 gigs for men who might dig a canal for 10 hours a day, at a mere $2 a day, hardly, you know, appealing work, over 12,000 people applied.
And the situation on the farm was particularly disruptive. Already through the 1920s, you know, there had been a deflation, but with the severe collapse of farm prices after the financial crisis, you really see the foreclosure rate and the, you know, the rate of sales through forced sales double, triple, and quadruple in different parts of the farm economy. In Iowa, farm foreclosures go from 30 per 1,000 farms before 1929 to 72. In Minnesota, they go from 31 to 59. You know, these are the wheat belt states in the Midwest. In the South, the problem's even more severe. You see farm foreclosures per 1,000 go from 14-49 in Alabama, 19-77 in North Carolina, 31-57 in South Carolina. Between 1926 and 1932, gross farm income fell by about 54%. So the ability to pay off mortgages to buy anything that isn't produced on the farm itself is almost completely eliminated and forces communities to have to reorganize themselves in a way to merely survive.
And you could see the devastation in the kind of social composition of households. So marriage rates declined, birth rates declined, families were torn apart by the devastation. There were increases in suicides. Children just did not have enough to eat. So surveys of schools in Pennsylvania found that somewhere between 85 and 99% of children were underweight. And the surveyors described them as drowsy and lethargic. And so, you know, when we talk about a crisis of social reproduction, this is precisely what we're thinking about.
Yeah, Michael Denning, kind of friend of the podcast, said under capitalism, the only thing worse than being exploited is not being exploited. And that certainly felt true, I think, for many of the people surviving the era. But even those who did retain employment often were doing so in more abject and exploitative conditions than before. There was the reemergence of the sweatshop, particularly in Pennsylvania. Emma, you might remember the numbers on this.
It was 200,000 women and children were found in grossly illegal working conditions like sweatshops.
You know, Ben, you made me think of another great line from that piece by Michael Denning, which is capitalism begins not with the offer of work, but with the imperative to earn a living. And what you see in the years after 1929 is that when it became impossible to earn a living for millions of people, they had to find other ways of making a living one way or another. And we see this in, you know, a whole variety of forms of just basic survival struggles that happened, you know, initially in an uncoordinated way. Just across the country, you know, like we've seen throughout history, when starvation is on the table, people do something, right? There are food riots, bread strikes. They'll raid an occasional food warehouse. They'll demonstrate in front of whatever tiny public or private relief agencies did already exist before the welfare state as we know it. People will turn, you know, more individually towards informal modes of surviving, like becoming hobos, who will travel around the country on boxcars without paying for it. And get food kind of where and when they can find it, you know, maybe proverbially stealing a pie that's warming on a windowsill. And we also began to see fairly quickly the emergence of organized efforts in some way or another. And a really notable one that really frightened a lot of people in the U.S. was the Bonus Army, which was a nationwide march of unemployed veterans of the First World War who marched all the way to D.C., to demand that Congress approve an early payment of their bonus, right? So they sort of saw this veterans bonus as an asset they had that they wanted to cash in on. And they show up and they set up, you know, tent cities in Anacostia. And ultimately, the tent city is cleared, you know, by Douglas MacArthur, no less, with violence.
Police are entering the first of a score of old buildings appropriated by bonus seekers to clear them out. In some spots, the bonus seekers fortify themselves, too strongly placed for the police. 1,500 men of the regular army answer the president's call, cavalry, tanks, and infantry. The president declared that many of those remaining were communists or criminals, with few veterans among them.
All shacks and tents were destroyed after the occupants had taken away their belongings. Some of the departing campers set the dwellings afire with their own hands, causing a pall of smoke to swirl upward toward the capital itself. At night, the troops crossed the Anacostia and cleared Camp Marks, which blazed for hours, a beacon that the fight was over and all was once more quiet along the Potomac.
Within, you know, sort of a striking distance of the White House, there's been, you know, what people look at and see the sort of outline of a potential revolutionary disorder.
Yeah, what's the line that, you know, Hoover looked over into the camps and saw nothing but a bunch of Bolsheviks when in fact it's a group that mostly wanted a ham sandwich.
Yep.
And all of this tremendous energy necessitated by the crisis of social reproduction does not have a clear direction or outlet in the first 2 years of the Depression. Through 1930, many people, you know, they acknowledge this financial panic happened, but the idea of the Great Depression, as we now remember it and as it's now taught, was not the first thing everybody wanted to acknowledge.
There is no reason on earth why the American people should be lacking either in confidence in the immediate future or have any doubt as to the ultimate future of their country.
I think that absence of leadership is something important for listeners to understand in thinking about how the conditions for organization would emerge. The American Federation of Labor, which had fallen in membership all throughout the 1920s, is really nowhere to be found, and actually adopts a derogatory nickname, its critics adopted, of the American Separation of Labor, because it seems incapable of uniting working people in this moment of crisis to do anything.
And they weren't just doing nothing. They were sometimes opposing some of these strategies, right? So the AFL leadership consistently opposed calls for a minimum wage in these years. You know, they were upset about the bread riots, right? Because they were concerned about their members who were bakers rather than unemployed people who didn't pay any union dues.
And it's kind of a striking opposition that emerges in cases like that, because on the one hand, the AFL, which is some form of labor leadership, openly opposing the struggles of working class people. And then on the other hand, you have people who maybe had never participated in a union before, maybe had not been political before, who were organizing themselves and taking on leadership positions themselves. Often it was women, because the crisis of social reproduction was a crisis of the household. And if women's kind of traditional roles had been to manage households and to manage food production and consumption, their traditional roles were no longer possible, or it was no longer possible to do them in the same ways that they had before. So women became quite politically organized in many cities. They organized actions against evictions. They organized bread strikes. In one city, they organized against utility shutoffs by hanging all of their wet laundry across the city's utility lines. And so, you know, you have this radical organizing occurring in places where it didn't typically happen, not at work sites, at formal work sites. Meanwhile, you have the AFL creating obstructions to that mobilization. And in the absence of that formal leadership, a different organization steps in.
So into this vacuum left by the American Separation of Labor steps an organization which is small but extremely dedicated. And that's, you know, the American Communist Party, which formed as one descendant of the Debs era Socialist Party we've talked about before. And there are, you know, only a couple thousand members of the Communist Party at this point. And they're in what they call the third period, which is following a Soviet directive, strategic outlook, where they expect the crisis of capitalism is here and the time has come to really be aggressive and militant, to not work with liberals or reformers or even socialists. And they make that switch in 1928 and almost immediately are rewarded, you know, with the vindication of their expectation of a great crisis. And so they're ready for this. And they start to organize mass movements of the unemployed. And this sort of debuts publicly in March 1930, when they have an International Unemployment Day that's actually organized by communists around the world. So this happens in other cities, in Paris, as well as in New York, Detroit, Chicago, and really dozens of other smaller U.S. cities. And even though the Communist Party, like I was saying, was a really small, you know, organization of a few thousand people, they were able to turn out crowds of 50 or 100,000 people in some of these largest cities in the U.S. The success took the communists by surprise. It certainly alarmed the ruling class. There were dozens of people wounded by police repression that included submachine guns, tear gas, horses, you know, scenes that radicalized a lot of people just from seeing the state response. It's also notable that just 11 weeks after this International Unemployment Day in 1930, Congress created a new special committee to investigate communist activities in the United States. So, you know, we think about McCarthyism and the Red Scare, something happening a little later, but it really gets going even before the New Deal. And there's an important character here, a communist leader who we've actually mentioned before on this episode, and that's William Z. Foster, who was the son of an Irish Republican. He grew up in South Philadelphia. And he spent time in just about all the organizations we've talked about in earlier episodes, including the Socialist Party, the Industrial Workers of the World, and sort of most importantly, his biggest organizing feat was to organize these monumental struggles in the meatpacking industry in Chicago during World War One, and then in the steel industry in 1919, just after the end of the war. And this, you know, the steel strike, as we've talked about, ended in a defeat. But you know, even his enemies kind of had to admit that Foster was a kind of genius of organization for pulling off, you know, anything on the scale of those strikes. And so Foster is sort of the key link between the Communist Party and the idea of industrial unionism. And so he will be really important here, not just in regards to the unemployed movement, but also something called the Trade Union Unity League, which we'll talk about in more detail later.
Some of these like unemployed marches were massive. There was a giant riot led by one of them in Dearborn. I think it was one of the largest kind of marches of the period. Dearborn in Michigan, obviously. Also close to the center of the automotive industry and
literally to the gates of the Ford plant.
Right. To demand not relief from the government, but to demand that Ford give everyone a job. And of course, many of those who were in the ranks of that march were, of course, former workers in the automotive industry. And many of them who were in those ranks also went on to form the nucleus of what becomes the United Auto Workers in the years to kind of follow. Another big march is obviously in New York City, which became the kind of seat of a lot of Foster's activity and of course, is a kind of headquarters of sorts for American communism. The march is massive, and the city government is really intent on making sure that it doesn't happen. You'll have no doubt seen images from the strike, some of the most iconic pictures of the kind of high watermarks of American communism. Foster is getting ready to lead a march from Union Square, close to at the time as the Communist Party headquarters, over to City Hall, just across Lower Manhattan. The city is really intent on making sure the march doesn't happen. The area is flooded with police. The chief of police offers, you know, Foster, why don't you call the march off and you can take a ride, a personal ride in my car over to the mayor's office for an audience with him. Foster refuses that. Instead, insists on holding the kind of mass demonstration, which takes place and is violently repressed. Foster ends up spending 6 months in prison. It has an adverse quality on his health, really negatively impacts him.
So what's, you know, what's sort of notable about the role that the communists played, in addition to just, you know, logistical organizing, which is, you know, shouldn't be gainsaid by itself, but they're also sort of the way that they coordinate people to demand, articulate their demands for relief in a new way. The idea, you know, that the state was something you could demand something from, right, rather than, you know, looking to charity. And this was a real distinction to the AFL, which, as we've talked about before, had a philosophy called voluntarism, which really, you know, to oversimplify a little bit, held that unions shouldn't really get involved in politics. You know, they should focus on the contract with the employers on protecting the union contract, you know, which again would have covered just, you know, a small number of skilled craft workers. So the idea that you could organize people who didn't belong to a union, who didn't even have a job, into making some kind of demands on local, state, national governments was a, you know, a new thing for a lot of people. And as often happens in times of crisis, you know, these new ideas and these new repertoires spread like wildfire, right? And it's actually really interesting to see how this stuff gets taken up in the African-American community, which, you know, in the 1930s, as always in American capitalism, when white unemployment is, you know, 25%, it's got to be 50% for Black people, right? So, you know, the unemployment crisis is really touching, you know, most Black workers at this time. And there's a really interesting case of a guy down in Atlanta, someone who's just a teenager when he joins the Communist Party, named Angelo Herndon. And, you know, he was just, you know, in some kind of a struggle, and someone handed him a copy of the Communist Manifesto, and he liked it. And, you know, so at age 17 or something, he becomes an organizer for the Communist Party and was working specifically on some of these unemployed campaigns. His big act is in 1932. He leads a march of both Black and white people, unemployed people, 1,000 of them, to the town center of Atlanta, which is, you know, a very alarming sight for anyone in the Southern ruling class. And Herndon ends up getting charged with a law that existed in Georgia on the books against insurrection. It was a law going back to the Reconstruction era that had stayed on the books. And Herndon is initially sentenced to 18 to 20 years hard labor on the chain gang. The Communist Party, of course, you know, responds to this by making it a huge cause célèbre, organizing around Angelo Herndon, publishing his writings, and ultimately the Georgia law is struck down by the Supreme Court. So that's a big victory for the Communist Party, which had something called the International Labor Defense at this time, or ILD, which focused specifically on some of these legal cases. And a more famous case where the ILD got involved was the case of the Scottsboro Boys, which, you know, almost everyone has heard about in some ways.
No, I think the Scottsboro Boys. And tell something about how you came to make up that song and You know the Scottsboro boys, don't you? Haven't you met them? Tell who they were and what their case was and how you met them.
Yes, ma'am. Miss, I'll tell you all about the Scottsboro boys because we had a sale once. And the Scottsboro boys both got out from down that hard world. That Alabama's a hard world down there. And the Scottsboro boys had a long time, 6 years that time, them four boys what got out. And I met them, and the boys had such a hard time, and I've been through down in that hard world, but I didn't stay long. And when I saw the Scottsboro boys, I shook their hand and began to thinking about and hear what I said about the Scottsboro boys, because I know they had a hard time. And here's the advice I give Joe Lewis, and this is the advice I give to all the Harlem colored people, and what I mean all the good colored people. And you better watch out. The landlord gets you gonna jump and shout. Scottsboro boys, they can tell you what it's all about. Call them landlords if they get your boy to go hang you. Go to Alabama and you better watch out. The landlord gets you gonna jump and shout. Scottsboro boys, tell you what it's all about. I'm gonna talk to Joe Lewis.
You know, this is a case of a group of black youths charged with the rape of two white women, and the trial took place in Alabama. And for our purposes, I think what's really interesting about the Scottsboro trial, in addition to the fact that the communists and the ILD ended up providing the legal defense for these youths when the NAACP wouldn't touch it because it was too explosive. What's interesting is I think if you use the social reproduction lens to look at Scottsboro, you know, you can sort of see it in a different light, right? So both the Scottsboro boys themselves and the two women they allegedly raped were people traveling, like hundreds of thousands of other Americans, as hobos on trains looking for work, right? That's why all these people were on a train together. And certain, you know, barriers were kind of coming down of necessity, right? There were men and women, black and white, in one boxcar together. And it's sort of the surfacing of that that creates the shock and the scandal and the Scottsboro moment. You know, it's also worth noting that the two white women involved, one of whom I should note, quickly recanted and became an advocate of justice for the Scottsboro boys, which was really interesting. The two women involved were unemployed cotton mill workers, right? So they came from one of the hardest hit industries, you know, the textile industry. They also worked sometimes as sex workers, which was, you know, another kind of survival strategy that ended up coming up in the trial, as it often does, as a way to impugn their credibility. And when they were found on the train, they were dressed in men's overalls, right? So you can see this whole sort of thing is just a, you know, the rules and the lines that used to guide the social order are coming apart. And that inspires not just radical organizing, but, you know, violent reaction, right? Such as the attempt to imprison or even kill people like the Scottsboro boys.
Judy, what did the Scottsboro boys do anyway to get in all this trouble?
Well, they was down there and they supposed to been riding on a freight train. And they riding in the boxcar and they run up on some white women. They was had on pants and they was riding too. All was supposed to been beaten away up to coming this way. And so down in Alabama, I guess the train stopped in the yard down there somewhere. Well, and some of them found all the boys and girls in the same boxcar. Some was different cars. And so I guess it's some of the people down there, they just said, well, you see them boys not with them white women. That was the trouble about it. Then they went out and made some loud cry about the boys being there with the women, you see. That is all it was to it. They just saw the women. They didn't see nothing else wrong. But anyhow, they put the boys in jail, and it's in that 6 long years. Well, the state, all the whole United States got together, and they got out four of them to come to New York. And the lawyer what got them out, I know him pretty good. I've met him. And he showed me the Scottsboro boys, and I shake hands with them, so I made this little song about down there. So I advise everybody to be a little careful when they go along through that, but stay woke, keep their eyes open.
On this point about transients, in some cases, communists played a kind of leading role in organizing the unemployed, organizing against evictions and things like that. But in other cases, they mostly provided a space where the jobless or the transient could just be and could talk to one another, and politics kind of emerged from there. So Tim talked about hoboing. There was a tremendous growth in hoboing or tramping or just general transience as a result of the Depression, as a result of both unemployment as well as farm foreclosures. You know, it's a really difficult thing to quantify for, I think, obvious reasons, to say how many people were hobos in 1932. But in 1933, there was an attempt to make an estimate of how many people were transient. In 809 cities, people who were being sheltered or cared for by participating public and private agencies were counted among the transient and homeless. And it was estimated that 1.2 million were unhoused, and 50% of those were thought to be transient. So, you know, this is a large number of people who are kind of on the move. And what the communists could do in some cases was just to provide a headquarters where they could rest. So in Chicago, for example, the communists created a headquarters for their unemployed council where the jobless would just kind of hang out without derision necessarily, which, you know, there's often a lot of like stigma attached to being a hobo. And so just having that kind of physical space meant that when an eviction was happening a few blocks away, or a woman was kind of denied relief by a local relief authority, they would come to this headquarters and find other people just kind of hanging out and rally them to the cause. And so just providing that kind of like physical space for people who were on the move and needed a break or didn't have anywhere to go and didn't have a job to go to was itself a kind of important political function that the communists played.
Just something as simple as free food, right? Like people would go to a communist meeting because they knew there might be something to eat there.
Yeah.
You know, even people who are super critical of the kind of like revolutionary third period for the Communist Party and its sectarianism and excesses, like even they will have to acknowledge what's remarkable about the third period was that the dedication on the part of communists to organize the real breadth of the working class, or at least a try to organize the breadth of the working class in the United States. So, you know, we've talked so much about the different kind of like zones and the kind of internal hierarchies of working class life. And what's interesting in the third period is this dedication to organizing Black workers, this dedicated to organizing sharecroppers of tenants of women, as well as kind of immigrants. And in some cases, you know, even agitating around things like sexual freedom and abortion, traces an outline of a kind of both a kind of egalitarianism, which could sometimes mark communist organizing, but also their kind of commitment to organizing a kind of unified proletariat throughout all of its kind of internal diversity and throughout all of its other strategic zigzags. That is, I think, a hallmark of so much of their political activity in the period.
Yeah, so there are other, out of necessity, other organizations are formed to deal with the deflation and unemployment. We've talked about ways unemployed workers organize themselves. Another imperative for many people was some sort of control over prices, particularly the sales prices of, you know, agricultural commodities across the South. That cotton is a major commodity, and common sense solution to dealing with abundance to the extent that it drives prices down below costs is to restrict production. So you end up with these holiday associations, holiday plans to prohibit planting across the South. You know, the newly elected governor of Louisiana, Huey P. Long, makes a name for himself promoting the idea of a cotton holiday, and actually passes legislation in his state to say that cotton planting will be restricted by the state, and you know, with the trigger of, you know, the other cotton producing states agreeing to this as well. And in the, you know, the wheat belt, you have a similar opportunity in the form of the Farmers Holiday Association, which is, you know, about 6 months after Huey Long's cotton holiday fails. This is led by somebody named Milo Reno, who is a radical, but he's not a communist. The heterogeneous nature of radicalism in the Depression is something that's worth acknowledging. The Farmers' Holiday movement similarly had the idea of prohibiting farmers from planting. And, you know, farmers understood intuitively that in so doing, prices would rise and their incomes would rise. The ad hoc nature of it is evident in the ways particular communities responded. You know, there's the national idea of a farmer's holiday, but also in places where, like in Lamar's, Iowa, where, you know, the county courthouse is processing all of these bankruptcies, you would have a crowd of farmers show up and close the court and threaten to hang the judge if he continued with the day's business of you know, hearing cases. And so this is an indication of all the different kinds of organization that working people undertook to protect themselves.
Yeah, that organization was not always taking place outside of the boundaries of the workplace. There were many people still working. 2/3 of Americans that are participating in the labor market still were able to kind of boast of having a job or complain about having a job. And there was, in turn, early efforts at unionizing, an early effort developing kind of robust workplace organization, often beyond the precincts of the AFL, often beyond what would become, you know, the kind of styles of organization that predominate the CIO. These kinds of early forms of unionization blurred the boundaries of the community and the workplace, that it drew on that kind of tempest kind of happening in protests for relief and unemployed councils and forms of community solidarity and what we call today, like, you know, mutual aid. Some of those unions, I think it's just worth pausing and naming a few of them. There was the Nut Pickers Union in St. Louis, which we discussed in earlier episodes as a kind of earlier city that was a high watermark of working class organization in the 19th century. In this instance, an interracial group of kind of nut pickers in the city's agricultural kind of industry successfully helped collapse the wage differential between white and black workers. And then when a number of their workers were laid off, pivoted instead to becoming an organization that protested for relief. Their central nucleus of decision-making was not necessarily comprised exclusively of workers on what was within the industry, but would also include what we call auxiliary members, community members, wives of workers, family members. And so that kind of strike organization, the strike committees, which was the real leadership of the union, had a both community and workplace kind of dimension to it. There are other examples of this kind of porousness that kind of defined the period before the kind of inauguration of legislation, which governed, protected, but also helped mold and narrow the shape that working class organization might take on the shop floor. There was a union called the Independent Union of All Workers that wasn't just wall-to-wall industrial organizing in a particular plant, but would organize all the workers in a particular city. So you'd have waitresses alongside people who were meat packers, alongside people who were maybe electrical workers. And they would often kind of have the kind of solidarity and mutual respect of their picket lines that would be made illegal before long. You know, there are some historians that really want to point, you know, really want to underline what was unique and special about this moment of organization. It posed some challenges to cross-workplace coordination. It was often more horizontal. It didn't often have a stable organizational basis, or at least that's what some of its critics would say. But the kind of permeability meant greater opportunities for women's leadership, that auxiliary organizations, community groups, informal deliberation, and mass meetings all provided different kinds of spaces for women's leadership that really did narrow as the movement did become more established, more institutionalized, and in some cases, bureaucratized.
Fragile Juggernaut is brought to you by Haymarket Books, publisher of a wide range of essential books, especially relevant to listeners like you. One that you might be particularly interested in reading is Radical Unionism, The Rise and Fall of Revolutionary Syndicalism by Ralph Darlington. During the first two decades of the 20th century, the ideas of revolutionary syndicalism developed into a major influence within the trade union movement. Committed to destroying capitalism through direct industrial action and revolutionary trade union struggle, the movement raised fundamental questions for militants across the world. Radical Unionism provides an analysis of the dynamics and trajectory of the syndicalist movement in six specific countries: France, Spain, Italy, the US, Britain, and Ireland, and offers a systemic explanation of the relationships between syndicalism and communism. Find Radical Unionism at haymarketbooks.org, where all paperback books are 20% off every day.
But right by Harry Bridges stands every working man.
Oh, the FBI is worried, the boss says they are scared. They can't deport 6 million men they know.
So another important thing happening in this period, you know, sort of within what we recognize as traditional workplace organizing, although we shouldn't understate how new some of these approaches were at the time, is something I mentioned earlier when we were talking about William Foster and the communists. And that's the Trade Union Unity League, which is sort of sort of supposed to be the Communist Party's core of an alternative labor federation to the AFL, right. One which will be organized on industrial lines, right? So organizing the unorganized, right? Whether that means in basic industry like steel or auto, or also in agricultural work, right? Where the tool was also interested in organizing Mexican and Filipino farm laborers in the Imperial Valley. And that was also happening, you know, in these early years. And the numbers are unclear, but we know that at one point in 1933, there were around 35,000 people involved in strikes led by the Trade Union Unity Council, which was associated with this. And, you know, if you take into account all the workers who passed through it in one way or another, we're probably talking about, you know, more than 100,000 or, you know, several hundred thousand people.
That was in New York City alone.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people around the country and in some of these places that haven't been organized. And it's also important to note that this is an explicit strategy of dual unionism, right? So at other points, the Communist Party had and would again in the future try to work within existing unions, right? But at this moment in the third period, they're actually just saying, you know, we don't care if there's an AFL union representing some auto workers, we're going to have our own. And so that also lays the groundwork for industrial unionism as it'll develop later in the decade. And these tool organizers and veterans and workers in these shops kind of punch above their weight. If you end up looking at the later history of some of the CIO unions, a lot of these people had passed through a tool shops. Tool also provided a link backwards to traditions like the Wobblies, mm-hmm. right? And someone like Foster represents that. So it's sort of like at a very important moment before something like the CIO exists, before any political party or major labor federation is supporting industrial unionism, you know, this is a space for some of those militants to connect across generations.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people point to Tool and they say, what an abject failure that was. This is typically the consensus amongst historians that Tool was really sectarian, that it isolated itself from the main currents of American labor, that it spent more time talking about defending the Soviet Union than it did concrete conditions on the job site. I mean, the historical record is a little bit more checkered than that. I mean, for one, a lot of these efforts at early unionization before the passage of federal relief and a new kind of system for recognizing and defending the practice of collective bargaining, a lot of strikes were ending in pretty dismal failure, often violent repression. But Tool does fit the mold. But they did have some successes. The kind of agricultural workers that Tim talked about, 13 of their 18 strikes won. These are, again, immigrant laborers picking cotton, picking peas, picking strawberries. In New York City, their Trade Union Unity Council won 65% of the walkouts they organized in 1931 and 1932. These weren't just defensive walkouts to protect wage increases. They were sometimes offensive efforts to kind of win union recognition. You know, but 33 is really the year where they come into their own, when they win something like 20 to 35% wage increases, still in some of the worst years of the Depression, as well as a 35-hour work week that many of us, I think, would love to have. One out of five strikes in the country in 1933 was led by Tool. And much like Ewok today, they were pretty small shops. They were overwhelmingly concentrated in light rather than heavy industry, you know, meaning industries with less capital-intensive tools and machinery. They tended to be smaller shops, too, with less than 300 employees. So I guess in some ways, it's kind of like, you know, DSA's efforts with Ewok, the Emergency Workplace Organizing Council. It's really taking hold in some smaller shops, but the early efforts did not break through to some of the highest, largest employers, the highest concentration of workers. It's maybe worth saying here that Tool, you know, was marked obviously by its explicit relationship to communism, but also, you know, it had other features to it, other kind of, I think, characteristics that kind of gave the name communist some meaning. And for Tool, it was at least an aspirational commitment to a more democratic organization, activist participatory unionism or bottom-up unionism, one that was led by its rank-and-file members as opposed to the kind of top-down approach that, you know, characterized the petty fiefdoms and dictatorships of most of the craft unions of the AFL. They really did try to organize, again, parts of the working class that were largely excluded from the AFL. They reached out to younger workers, to women, and to African-Americans. They almost always criticized themselves for not quite doing enough, and their records in the early years were still uneven. But they definitely held that as a real goal of what they wanted to do. Maybe most importantly, though, that they really kind of organized unions on a shop delegate basis, developing leaders who were workers that came directly out of the shops, that developed kind of organs of democratic deliberation, like the strike committees comprised of workers, who could go on to lead the strikes. Once again, their record of actually doing so is uneven, but it remains, you know, this is a kind of set of watchwords and calling cards to how they wanted to organize, and that kind of later matures into the stamp of how communists organized in the CIO for the later part of the 1930s, particularly in terms of the kind of like shop councils that predominate the UAW or kind of mark the way that they work within UE. This is the kind of like, you know, Stewart's network style of organizing that is both militant and democratic and really interested in flexing direct power on the shop floor. So in some ways, again, a kind of looking back or a connection to this earlier wobbly tradition.
I read a self-criticism in one of the worker papers that while they had been successful in a strike, they had failed to take every opportunity to develop new leaders. So, you know, just kind of like to emphasize that point about how they were thinking strategically and how that experience and that kind of thinking is going to play an important role in the coming years.
And one place where we see a lot of this, you know, kind of development of organic, you know, bottom-up leadership is in the case of coal, which I think we're going to take a little bit of time to talk about today.
Yeah, along with the textiles industry, which is, you know, characterized by a large number of small firms with low barriers to entry, the coal industry is suffering from a severe deflation already throughout the 20s and then really with the onset of the Depression. The effect of this is to drive many of the operators, the employers, to make war on the union. So in the soft coal industry, for example, which is like 7 out of 8 coal miners, the total workforce had been something like 640,000 at its peak during World War I. Over half of those, 320,000, are members of the United Mine Workers of America. The industry's ability to pay union wages, which in 1920 had been set at $7.50 a day, which, you know, winning a daily wage rather than an hourly or piece rate was a huge success during World War I. The industry's ability to pay those wages depended on the price of coal, which is a little above $4 a ton for the railroads, which are paying the highest prices in 1920. That price per ton of coal falls throughout the decade by about half to $2.40 a ton on the eve of the Depression. And once the financial crisis happens, it continues to fall down below $2 a ton. The effect on employers is tremendous. And the industry, the large operators in the industry, undertake a series of lockouts and reopenings under non-union terms already in the late 1920s, but before the Depression begins. So the Mine Workers Union, which had over 300,000 members in coal at the beginning of the decade of the 1920s, just collapses under this employer assault, falling to less than 80,000 members by 1930. The union, which had divided over how to respond to falling membership before the crisis, is at its most intense moment of internal conflict and divides into what are effectively several different unions, in part because, you know, of the strategy of dualism, which we had just been talking about in regards to the Communist Party. So by 1930, there's not only the United Mine Workers of America, which is John Lewis's UMWA, there's also something called the National Miners Union, the NMU, which is led by communists. And then in addition, there are the Progressive Mine Workers, which tries to claim the title to the International and actually holds a simultaneous convention in 1929 to claim that it is the United Mine Workers of America. So the union really falls into crisis with the Depression, and the economic solution is nowhere in sight. Coal prices continue to fall. By 1932 at the mine, buyers are paying $1.31 a ton, which is down to about a quarter of what it had been 10 years earlier.
We talk about coal miners a lot on the show, I think because like coal miners really do form something that's as close as we get to kind of a real social vanguard in this era of the kind of workers' movement. I mean, that's true across the world. You know, in Germany, the miners in the Ruhr region play a kind of leading role in the kind of struggles for what was then the kind of high watermark of, you know, workers' movement organization. And that's also true in the United States for, you know, Western mine workers and their role in the formation of the IWW, of their kind of long-standing both philosophy and practice and political commitment to organizing industrially, but also expanding into previously unorganized parts of later parts of the production process that the raw materials of the mines go into feeding. And the mine workers remain super important for this kind of period in the 30s and the 40s. We're going to talk a bit about Harlan County, which represents, you know, maybe one of the most well-known, one of the bloodiest strikes in American history, one that certainly has been mythologized in no small part due to the efforts of the workers themselves there and the activists that flooded the county in solidarity. Maybe we should first talk a bit about what the conditions in Harlan in particular were.
Yeah, so, you know, what's interesting about coal miners and makes them such a dynamic kind of social force at this time is that they have this huge structural power because they're, you know, the thing they produce is essential to running, you know, the railroads, the steel mills, to heat homes, really to provide much of the energy that the country needs. At the same time, they work in really just abject conditions, right? The writer Lewis Mumford once compared coal mining to a combination of the terrors of the dungeon with the physical exacerbation of the galley, right? Like a slave galley. Fatality rates were really high. They were four times as high in U.S. mines than they were in Britain and France. And in company towns like those in Harlan County, the workers were just completely dominated by their bosses. You know, there's a historian named Michael Goldfield who's written a lot about the vanguard role of miners in these years. And he has a list of, reasons you could be evicted from your company-owned house, right? If you went out on strike, if you had visitors over, particularly if those visitors were unionists, if someone in the family died, if you looked for another job, if you didn't buy enough things at the company store, if you tried to buy things at a different store, the company always knew where you were. And Goldfield notes that even on some occasions, company agents and thugs would pull sick miners out of their bed and send them to work. So we're really talking about, you know, a kind of a personal domination that's near total. At the same time, the miners down in the shafts are working together, right? And they're all doing, in some ways, the same kind of work. They all go down and they all come up together. So this is really an explosive situation. Harlan County in particular was known for the poor sanitary conditions prevailing in these company-owned towns. You know, into the 1970s, some of these places still didn't really have modern plumbing. But in the 1930s, they were, you know, just complete nightmares. It's noteworthy that Harlan County didn't have any kind of public health apparatus until World War II. And the reason that they finally got one was that an entire one-third of the people drafted the military out of Harlan County were rejected for medical reasons, mostly venereal disease. So that gives you a sense of just like the levels of human suffering and deprivation going on there. But, you know, as you would guess, maybe from the rest of the episode, the coal miners didn't accept their misery or fall into silence and apathy. And in fact, you know, starting in 1931 and building into 31 and 32, we see a whole wave of strikes across the coal fields, often led by communists or other independent radicals. Harlan is one of these. And these strikes are desperate, you know, they fail, but they help provide a reserve of militancy that actually does lead to a chain reaction, which leads to some successes.
One of maybe the most remarkable inheritances that we have of this strike, it's a strike that, you know, wasn't a victory, but ended up giving, you know, a generation of militants, a couple of generations of mine worker militants, a kind of immediate reference point to help explain their own intransigence, their hatred of the boss, their desire for organization and a better condition. It's one that, you know, gets talked about in the mythology of the American labor movement pretty often. But maybe the most important inheritance is the song that it kind of gave us. You know, Bernstein, the historian we keep citing in this episode, he says, he has a beautiful line where he says, "The troubles in coal were singing troubles, and the mournful songs the miners sang echoed down the years." Which side are you on, which is maybe the kind of anthem of the labor movement we all know best, was actually first penned in this context. Florne Reese was the wife of a local coal organizer, Sam Reese. And the apocryphal story goes that when armed deputies ransacked his cabin, you know, he went on the run. And Florence had to kind of face off against the deputies alone. As they were kind of, you know, running around her house, tearing it apart, looking for radical literature, or really just an excuse to kind of make her life hell, she tore off a sheet of her wall calendar that was nailed to some dank board in her small home and wrote "Which Side Are You On" to the tune of an old Anabaptist hymn, "Lay the Lily Low." The song spoke of the kind of stark Manichaean lines of division of bosses and scabs and gun thugs on one side and workers bound together by organization on the other.
Come on, you poor workers, good news to you, I'll tell how the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? If you go to Harlan County, there is no neutral there. You'll either be a union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
We should probably talk a little bit about this strike in Harlan, you know, which ran from February through June of 31. It was immediately precipitated by wage cuts. There was another 10% wage cut that they were, you know, workers were facing. You know, labor costs were the majority of costs, or a huge part of the costs of, I think, actually operating a coal mine. So employers were under a lot of pressure to continue cutting wages. And this is a long series of rollbacks on compensation the miners had kind of survived and were fed up putting up with. You know, one worker said, "We starve while we work. We might as well strike while we starve." You know, early efforts to kind of meet this radical grassroots groundswell of enthusiasm was first attempted by the United Mine Workers, and in particular, Philip Murray, who will go on to be a major figure in the CIO. He held a rally that I think 10,000 workers immediately signed up for the union. That's something which doesn't happen right away unless there's an already existing kind of current of radicalism in organization that he was tapping into. But soon after the strike gets underway, the UMW disappears. They kind of leave the scene as the intensive crescendo of violence grows. There's the moment called the Battle for Everts early on in the strike, I think on May 4th, when a carload of deputies with machine guns arrive into one of the mines or close to one of the mines in the picket lines. You know, there's a pitched battle. A number of men, both deputies and miners, die. And Harlan County increasingly becomes associated as with this kind of phrase of a dark and bloody ground. Raids are conducted on United Mine Workers' offices, looking for signs of IWW membership amongst the miners so that they can slap them with criminal syndicalism kind of laws and increase the kind of legally authorized repression that you can bring to the strikes. These are some of the same laws which broke the backs of radicals throughout the 1920s. So, you know, the UMW throws up its arms, says, "We're done with this." They inform the strikers this is now a wildcat, an illegal and unauthorized strike. And it's at this moment that the communists step into the breach, as they so often do in this early Great Depression period. You know, the Communist Party, you know, is interested in filling the vacuum for obvious reasons, because they're interested in helping amplify these instances of class struggle and provide it with certain kinds of leadership. The party in particular is in, you know, engaged in a kind of perennial search for a native-born American radicalism that they can champion too. They send Dan Brooks, an organizer for, you know, the National Miners Union, the Red Union, and Jesse Wakefield for the International Labor Defense, who Tim was talking about earlier, also comes to the aid of Scottsboro. And the party, like, sets about organizing strikes, organizing the relief, and also in particular really trying to dramatize and draw attention to the fight. You know, the party was really good at bringing together intellectuals with manual workers, and they played a role in dramatizing, mythologizing the strike, which was, in fact, remarkably bloody and an unvarnished instance of class warfare. I think they really were interested in it because class warfare became something other than a metaphor. You know, Aunt Molly Jackson, who's a radical folk singer, whose father and husband were miners, came from Kentucky to New York. She drew a crowd of over 20,000 people in the Bronx to support and fundraise for the strikes. And these kind of networks of sympathy for the strikers would be activated again and again as the 30s went on. You know, they organized an anthology called Harlan Miner Speaks that had, you know, Dos Passos and a number of other leading intellectuals contributed to. So it really was kind of a major cause for the CP in this period.
It's also, you know, another instance of the CP's commitment to racial integration and labor politics, which is, you know, especially striking in this case. You know, there are some places where, you know, Black workers are so important in the production process that it's just simple pragmatism, you know, to support interracial organization. But it seems that there were not especially large numbers of Black miners in Harlan County. Black miners were around 14% of the coal miners in Kentucky overall. But the Communist Party insisted, against the inclination of most of the white miners in Harlan, that their strike kitchens should be integrated. And they argued about this with the miners for hours and hours until eventually the miners gave in and the kitchens were integrated. So there you can see this, you know, this space to eat and reproduce yourself physically. There's a fight over what kind of a space that's going to be and who can be in it. And the communists are kind of, at this point in American history, like very weird for being white people who insist so strongly on this. The historian Theodore Draper, who was a bitter critic of the Communist Party and certainly no fan of theirs, says that it is fair to say that only the communists in that period, in the heat of battle, would have taken such a firm stand on this issue. And Draper further remarked that circumstances in Harlan were so adverse that whatever the communists did there seems somewhat incredible. And in the end, they did lose.
You know, one commentator said that described the repression like this. It was a systemic, unrelenting campaign. The forces of the coal guards roam the countryside at night, terrorizing the inhabitants. Meetings are broken up with tear gas bombs. Raids are conducted almost every night with the consequential toll of deaths. Houses are broken into, property confiscated, the mails are tampered with, the slightest resistance is met with the force of guns. I mean, even the Red Cross would double check if those appealing for aid were on strike, and if they were, aid was denied. And so through force of repression and starvation, ultimately the strike is broken. The NMU tries to call for a general strike in the beginning of the following year. It was disaster. They were unable to turn people out, in large part because they never succeeded in building the kind of like robust stewards networks and shop delegate sort of model of unionization that was so important for communist organizing elsewhere. But that, you know, more or less the strike kind of fits a pattern as maybe a more exemplary or dramatic case of a pattern that'll be familiar to anyone who's a student of American labor history up until this point, which is workers were legally and extra legally repressed, that they often found limited kind of opportunities, even in cases of robust organization, to launch successful strikes.
The United Mine Workers of America, a sort of once great industrial union, which had been hobbled by the Depression, didn't play much of a role in some of these early strikes, leaving the ground open to people like the Communist Party. But in time, the pressure coming from below and the disorganization in the coal industry was so sort of extreme that the UMW leadership had to sort of start to try to do something. And one direction that took actually before it took the form of a UMWA organizing drive was political lobbying, right? With the election of 1932, there's a new Democratic president, and there had already actually been an important victory in legislation in the form of the Norris-LaGuardia Act, which helped unions by making it illegal for employers to have a so-called yellow dog contract, which would ban a worker from belonging to a union as a condition of membership. Those contracts had been a very effective tool of operators in the coal industry, and they used it to blacklist people who had been union members or who were organizers. And the UMWA, sort of building from that victory, starts to push the new Roosevelt administration for something even bigger. The form that something bigger ends up taking is the National Industrial Recovery Act, or part of it, which is passed in 1933 and is sort of the centerpiece of the recovery aspect of the Roosevelt administration, at least in its sort of first guise. And the NIRA creates something called the National Recovery Administration, which is a really huge labyrinthine apparatus of legal codes regulating the rules of production and pricing in industry, right? It's a sort of an embrace of cartels or collusion as a way of managing this crisis, which people thought had come out of the anarchy of unplanned market competition. And so the NRA gets a lot of buy-in from a lot of business leaders, especially those in the large concentrated industries, right? It grows out of actually something called the Swope Plan, which is named after Gerard Swope, who was a General Electric figure who's close to Roosevelt in these years. But it's sort of, even though most of the bill is really focused on business and reviving business, it becomes clear that there's going to need to be something given to labor in this bill. And actually what happens first is there's a huge groundswell in support of a bill which actually does pass the Senate, which would legally require all companies producing for interstate commerce to limit the workday, or the working week rather, to 30 hours a week. That's sponsored by Senator Hugo Black, later a Supreme Court justice. It's the Black 30-hour bill. And people love the Black 30-hour bill. It's really, really popular. And the idea there is a kind of work sharing, right? That if everyone's working less, fewer people won't have to work at all. The Black bill is such a big deal that even the head of the AFL, William Green, who has typically had this sort of voluntarist attitude about not looking to legislation to solve workers' problems, even he ends up supporting it. At one point in the Senate, he ends up saying that he will call a universal strike or a general strike if the black bill doesn't pass. So, you know, the AFL is putting itself on the line for this too, in addition to the mine workers and others. But the Roosevelt administration, for various reasons, doesn't like the 30-hour idea. So they need to come up with something else. And that becomes Article Section 7A of the National Industrial Recovery Act.
Yeah. Section 7A reads that employees shall have the right to organize and bargain collectively through representatives of their own choosing and shall be free from the interference, restraint, or coercion of employers of labor or their agents in the designation of such representatives or in self-organization or in other concerted activities for the purpose of collective bargaining or other mutual aid or protection.
And it's worth maybe noting here just briefly that this language is written and inserted into the bill by people in the office of New York Senator Robert Wagner, who will end up being important later, and we'll talk about him again in later episodes. But, you know, there's a little bit of a mythology that's grown up around Section 7A. You know, the story is sometimes told that this law, right, coming from the top down and signed by Roosevelt, was the spark that lit the organizing drives that eventually became the CIO and really helped, you know, undergird American politics in these years and for decades afterwards. But, you know, as you might be able to guess, based on some of the history we've already talked about, that's not quite true. And we can look to Cole again to see just an illustration of how untrue this is, or how incomplete, let's say.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. While some of the titans of the United Mine Workers Organization are in D.C., lobbying, basically, workers themselves, all throughout these coal mines, particularly in northern Appalachia, but also as far south as Birmingham, they're starting to organize their own locals, rebuild their old locals that maybe existed before the crash, before maybe even the lean years of the 1920s. It's a really remarkable campaign. It's been described as one of the most successful and rapid organizing drives in American history. In a brief two-month period, the United Mine Workers added a staggering 300,000 members to its ranks. The Lady Garment Union, more than 100,000. The Amalgamated Clothing Workers, an additional 50,000. Lewis dispatches one of his loyal deputies, Van Bittner, to Western Virginia, where he's expected to kind of oversee these organizing drives while Lewis is kind of ensconed in the, you know, kind of the marble halls of D.C. And Bittner's letters give a texture on what's kind of happening in these coal mines across the country. The union plans on launching a kind of new drive for organizing right after the passage of this legislation to rebuild the miners' union in Maryland and Virginia, also West Virginia. And Lewis kind of sends him some reassuring notes in this period saying, yeah, the legislation's going really well. Things are going great in D.C. And by next week, I want you to start to pull together some meetings so that we can begin to tell the workers about the strength of this new legislation and the ways that it'll authorize new organizing. And Van Bittner writes him back in response in June 33, you know, the same month that the NRA became law, saying, sir, I've reported to you heretofore that the work of organizing the miners in West Virginia is progressing more rapidly than I ever dreamed of. Already, the entire Northern Field, as well as New River Winding Gulf, Kanawahana Field, Mingo and Logan, they're all completely organized. We shall finish up McDowell and Mercer and Wyoming counties this week. Similar reports, he wrote, came in from other coal regions in Maryland and Virginia. They'll be organized by the end of next week, he said. And, you know, again, this is all days before the UMW was even supposed to hold its very first meetings to extol workers to join a union under new NRA protections. Even Lewis's own biographer describes a situation where the new legislation was ultimately tangential, or at the very least it was secondary, to the sense that coal miners seemed to organize themselves in the late spring and early summer of 1933. Even in the absence of UNW funds and organizers, segments of that old vanguard of the American working class, the mine workers, are beginning to stand back up. Someone like Sidney Hillman, as policy-minded a leader as the labor movement would really kind of ever produce in this era, said with regard to NRA that, quote, you don't transfer power by statute. Section 7A can be enforced through strikes. You don't expect the government to send American working class to labor unions. That's the union's job. And true enough, and that is precisely what workers would soon come to understand and do the following year. But here, though, in the summer of 1933, we can start to see a situation that is kind of crystallizing, a situation that would produce a massive working class offensive. It includes the combination of new federal legislation, of increasingly confident parts of the working class to fight back, as well as now these new reservoirs of organization, particularly in the coal mines and in textiles. And all of this help lays the groundwork for what is that decisive year of 1934. Thank you. Thanks for listening to Fragile Juggernaut, a podcast on the meaning of the CIO. We will be releasing new episodes every other week through the duration of our series.
Come all of you good workers, good news to you I'll tell of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Our next episode covers the almost revolutionary strikes of 1934 in Toledo and San Francisco and Minneapolis and in the Cross America's textile belt, moments that dramatize the powerful interaction between a dynamic militant minority on the shop floor and mass working class struggles. These bloody fights would go on to produce a new social warrant for working class self-activity in the years to come. Fragile Juggernaut is hosted by our organizing committee, Alex Press, Andrew Elrod, Ben Mabee, Emma Teitelman, Gabriel Winant, and Tim Barker. We are produced by Alex Lewis and Jackson Roach at Row Home Productions, and we're brought to you by Haymarket Books as the first Haymarket Books Originals production. Make sure to follow and share the Haymarket Originals podcast feed so that you and your comrades are the first to know about other series-length nonfiction audio products coming in the months and years ahead. To learn more about Haymarket Originals, visit haymarketbooks.org, where you'll find thousands of indispensable radical books and other political education resources. You can also join the Haymarket Book Club, one of the best ways to support Haymarket and help fund projects like this. You can also find a link to our Patreon for Fragile Juggernaut in the show notes below. Subscribers to the podcast can get access to our newsletter. It features reading lists, further analysis, interviews with historians and labor radicals past and present. We really need your support to pay our talented producers, so if you're still listening, please throw us what cash you can at patreon.com. Solidarity forever.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Row Home Productions. Mm-hmm.